When Melissa offered to let me preach, she gave me a choice of my weeks in Lent, and the different scripture. And I looked through them and I thought, these all look fine, except for Luke 13, which seems like a bit much, for a first sermon. But it stuck in the back of my mind and I couldn't really stop because my aversion to it is what makes it useful. And Melissa has never been one to discourage me from reaching outside my comfort zone. So here we are, Luke 13. I am a deeply conflict-averse person. I realize that may come as a surprise to some people because I am stubborn as a donkey and have never met a hill I wasn't both willing and eager to die on. But when people get angry, it stresses me out badly. I do a lot to avoid it. Unsurprisingly, then, Jesus's anger also stresses me out, which is slightly unfortunate because Jesus does get angry a time or two in the Gospels. I mean, Jesus is God and God is known to get angry. None of the churches I was raised in were particularly fire and brimstone, but it's hard to grow up in American culture and not absorb at least some of that. Some sense that God's anger is an ever-looming threat, just waiting to rain fire and sulfur on us like the next Sodom. That makes a lot of stories difficult to read. Because with enough time, the association becomes baked in. Humans mess it up, and if we're lucky, God turns his face away. If we're not, in his anger, he starts sending the plagues. That's the culturally common depiction, anyway, the one that can easily start to lodge itself in the back of your mind. Suffice to say, God's anger can be viscerally terrifying. And there are a lot of uncomfortable Bible passages as a result. For someone to standing up here, of all places, I have a pretty hard time reading the Bible for that exact reason. And seeing Jesus lean towards it doesn't towards ire doesn't tend to brighten my day. So then in today's scripture, we see God as Jesus walking directly among us on earth, experiencing human cruelty, not as an observer, but as its personal target. He's down here stewing in the same brain chemical cocktail as the rest of us, through stress of life under occupation, through grieving his cousin's murder, through betrayal and rejection by the people he loves. I don't know what it's like to be God. I have no idea how to even conceptualize divine emotion, but I can't imagine adding human emotions on top makes that much better of an experience. But join me in this one for a second. The parallels are hard not to see. Both then and now, state violence looms, inevitable, inescapable, maybe, certainly imminent. Overhead stretches the long, dark shadow of a tyrant, unfaithful to his wife, who has recently made a public display of arresting and detaining a man for condemning his abuse of power. 2,000 years ago, that was John the Baptist. A week ago, Mahmud Khalil. The threat these would-be kings pose, we are painfully aware, is a very real and present danger to the people we care most about, cared most about in Jesus's case. Because, like I mentioned, by this point in the story, John is already dead. Jesus isn't yet, but the candle's burning low and he knows it. He's bringing Morn to run because Herod wants to kill him, and Taryn is going to win this one. It's a short road left to the cross, and it's Jesus's own people, including a close friend, who are paving it. So Jesus is, perhaps understandably, getting a little bit frustrated. And again, that's uncomfortable because we've read the stories, and God frustrated at humans doesn't tend to end very well for the humans. Except, we like to divide everything along the axis of Jesus' life. We have this explicit delineation between testaments. We mark dates as before and after year zero. But God didn't just wake up one morning as somebody else. That would be terrifying. Instead, we see our God genuinely reflected in Jesus, both the parts we're comfortable with and the ones we aren't. And that's part of how we're able to recognize that he is our God, our same God. Over and over and over again, we find Jesus getting frustrated in the Gospels. At hypocrisy in the temple, at the crowds who won't leave him alone, and certainly in these verses at Jerusalem. No matter how many times he preaches in synagogues or on hillsides, how many miracles he performs, how many times he tells people to keep awake, you just don't get it. Even the people in his parables fall asleep, like even his stories can't manage to do what he asked. But unlike the plagues of old, Jesus only kills once that I'm aware of, and it's a fig tree. So he is angry. This is not storybook Jesus with an unfaltering smile and infinite patience. But maybe there's a comfort in that continuity. Jesus is the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and God gets frustrated. The old adage goes that the opposite of love isn't hate, it's apathy. And God certainly isn't apathetic about us. In the reading, Jesus laments, "How often have I desired to gather you under her, your children together as a hen gathers her brood under her wings, and you were not willing. See, your house is left to you, desolate." It's a tale as old as Eden. God's desire to shelter and care for his creation in the garden, humans determinedly running toward the one and only tree they're not supposed to, God's frustration and his grief, the banishment then as an allowance of both free will and resultant consequence. Because we do have to be willing. The freedom isn't a farce. Our will demonstrably matters to God. It's why he lets us defy him. If we want to run off and hide under the henhouse straw, instead of under God's wings when we see the fox coming, Herod in this case, or the tyrannies of our time, then God will try to sweep us back into safety, but he won't force us to stay. That doesn't stop his frustration when we refuse to believe that the fox will find us anyway. But what his frustration begets is that he sits himself by the doorway and offers himself first. And there's a shift, right? In this little game of Roman politics, the fox has taken up occupation in the hen house. Rest assured, everyone in there is getting eaten. But what Jesus hasn't done is to flee or to set fire to the coop with the fox and us inside. Even in this despairing anger, even as his people turn away and he openly laments their unwillingness to remain at his side, Jesus does what God has always done. He stays faithful. If we're getting eaten, then so is he, and he's putting himself first in line for those teeth. He's not happy about it, and he doesn't seem to be making much effort to hide that fact. But in this moment, in this deep, persistent frustration, God's reaction isn't fire. Emmanuel, God with us, walks headfirst into the consequence, with us. Is a temper that has itself been tempered. I don't mean that in the sense of it being reduced or restrained in some way. I mean it in the sense that you temper metal. When you first quench a piece of steel after forging it, it's very hard but very brittle. It's prone to cracking or snapping under force, so you heat it again, slowly, carefully, and soften the structure of that metal to have just a little bit of give. That balanced give is ultimately what makes it useful, lets it flex or dent before it shatters. Humans may kindle God's anger, but they're the ones who temper it, too. Even in the case of Sodom, infamous as it is, and ironically still a source of harm thousands of years later, the destruction doesn't come out of nowhere. It comes because of an outcry. God considers whether or not to hide his plans from Abraham, decides he ought to tell him, and then stays and listens to Abraham's concern for good people getting caught in the crossfire. In response, God is wholly willing to stay his hand if that turns out to be the case. And in that context, Jesus' vehement, self-sacrificing defense of others feels like an obvious response to me. It feels like an anger, forged from an outcry, tempered by humanity, and then honed into a tool to protect. Neither Jesus nor God can sit by and watch, nor are they content with small, situational responses. Jesus is given a choice, and in the midst of his anger, he chooses not only to walk toward the tyrant, but to heal as he goes. He doesn't flee as he's warned to. He walks in full mortal vulnerability towards state violence, towards his occupied people living under that violence. Even as their rejection and disobedience is about to ramp to the point of literally putting God himself to death. In the face of all his pain and frustration, Jesus still refuses to turn away or leave us to our fate. He still comes to stand with us as us in solidarity. This anger tears down empires in defense of the oppressed and builds something new in its place, because it can't stand to see that continued hurt. So this is an anger I both know and welcome. It's not all that different from the kind that drives people out into the street to protest, an anger born of deep, risky love. It's love, love beaten into plowshares, love carving furrows not through flesh, but through the earth to plant something new. This anger builds communities. It tends the sick, feeds the poor, and it didn't die on a cross on Calvary 2,000 years ago. It lives on in every act of resistance against our neighbor's oppression and every defiance of empire. God is Jesus and Jesus is God, and they both get angry. And that anger is what saves us. Thanks be to God.